accession number 14282, reel 7.
Mr. Hooker, reel 7.
Well, every time this battery's had to be serviced, as I say, the Electrolux type topped up distilled water, we had to lug these concrete blocks off and put them on after. It was a bit of a chore, but we all knew the importance of batteries, and so it was unlikely that our particularly as our lives might depend on it, that and the crew, that we would have neglected them. Well, he accused us, and as it happened me, of neglecting them. So I stood, tried to stand up for the rail department, and he turned very nasty, and he said, "Look," he said, if I have any more of this," he said, "I will see that you are shanghaied out here on the west coast for 3 years." And he could have done it. I'd have had to sign off articles, and there were places in the world, you see, where Marconi guys were what they call on the coast. India was one place. You could go out there for 3 years and trading on ships going up and down the Indian coast, you see. The same was in West Africa. And it took 3 years, perhaps, sailing between ports there. And it was lousy places to be, actually, and it would have been pretty awful runs. Well, I didn't want that, so I kept quiet. Off he went. I told the Chief Sparks about it when he come on board. He was a Northern Irish guy. He was livid. He blew his top. He tried to get out of this. He morsed ashore to try and get out of this bloke, but he couldn't get out of him. So anyway, we got out of Freetown, thank God, and we couldn't get out there fast enough for me. And we sailed home, and it was uneventful, except I remember when we were about off jib, level with jib, a corvette came out from jib and joined the convoy as an escort, and there was a naval raiding with full pack at the double going around the ship. He'd obviously committed some sort of crime on board, and there was a rough sea too, but they had this guy doubling around the ship with full pack and rifle. Seemed unbelievable, really, but it was naval discipline, I suppose. So we the master, because of the shortage, water shortage, the master decided to ration the water. Now the idea was, it wasn't quite like the HMS Bounty when they had the water problem, where they tied the ladle. The ladle to the water butt up in the foremast, and you had to climb the mast and bring the ladle down and have a drink and then climb up again and put it back again. It wasn't quite as bad as that. But they deposited the handle of the pump, the water, fresh water pump, with the officer of the watch. Now, the water pump was one of these over and back pumps. It was outside the galley. You pump it to and fro. And it was detachable. It was usually held on with a little nut. And that was the handle of the pump. So every time any of the crew wanted to drink, they had to report to the officer of the watch on the bridge for the handle of the pump, have the drink, and return the handle of the pump to the bridge again. And this would go on until the vessel got home. Then they started running out of food. Didn't the second steward would come in, "Oh, we haven't got this into the... when he was serving the meals, "We run out of this, we run out of that." Every day you heard something they ran out of. Well, consequently was when the ship docked in the Mersey and she lay off, I suppose it was the Brunswick dock or something, waiting for the tide to go in into the docks, we had to morse ashore on the lamp for a message to be taken to the agents for food and water to be sent out to the ship immediately, which was done. And the next morning, I went in to breakfast and I saw these strange faces sitting around the breakfast table, and it was the wives of the senior officers. They'd come on board during the night, you see, and they were sat up to, well, to a banquet, the breakfast that was being served, compared to what we've been getting for the last 2 or 3 months, you know. And she really was an unhappy ship, and she had a lot of things happening to her. I mean, I remember when we were in at Jib, an American Liberty, it wasn't our fault, there was a storm brew up, and an American Liberty ship rammed us, smashed in a lifeboat, cracked the boat deck, and lay across our bow all night, and with the tide coming in, until a tug came along and took her off. So really, we had we had cracked plates. From the time we went on the breakwater in Brindisi, stays on the mast had been shot away. We went alongside and got her a second-hand lifeboat, and God knows what that was like. The boat deck was cracked, and we were going to do that trip down to Freetown and back, which must have been anything 5,000-6,000 miles, but we made it all right. But she was generally an unhappy ship, and I think the deal that had been done with the crew off was that when we were discharging in Brindisi, that they were discharging cases of spirit out of the number 2 hold, and I saw the donkey man come along, and you see the slings would go down, be lifted down the hole, filled up, and up and over the side of the ship onto the quayside, you see. Well, this one, when they pulled it up out of the hold and then deposited it on the foredeck, time enough for the donkey man to go up and lift out a case of gin. I always remember him going off with this case of gin on his shoulder. And I think possibly that was the deal that had been done, you see, a compromise had been reached. Well, that was up to them. Well, the Sparks weren't involved in it. So that was that vessel. I think we were all, the trip lasted 6 months. I think we were all pleased to get off her. So I went home, and a leave was always uncertain. If they were short of crew, they would, you could be sent back to sea without any leave at all.
This is the summer of 44 now we're talking about. In fact, round about the time of D-Day.
We were out in Brindisi, January, the beginning of January, that's right. It would be towards the end of May. Because when I signed off, they gave me and all the crew leaflet M254, the mass invasion of the continent. What is expected of the merchant navy? And Churchill wrote a speech, and he said, "We never call upon them in vain." So really, I was expecting to be not to get hardly any leave, and I would be involved in D-Day, you see. Well, we were given 2.5 days leave for every month. We were on articles, so I had about perhaps a fortnight's leave due, but that didn't mean to say you'd get all of it then, you see. So I went home on leave, and I remember waking, I went down on the beach for a swim about 10 o'clock in the morning, because they had the defences all along the beach at Budley, you know, the big stanchions and barbed wire, but they left a little gap where you could go down and get to the sea. And it must have been the morning of the 6th of June, because I heard, and I hadn't been called back, and I heard this terrific roar in the sky, looked up and saw the sky completely filled with aeroplanes. You could tell it was Dakotas, and they were towing gliders, but they were only about, what, 3,000 or 4,000 feet, I suppose, if that. So the noise was quite loud, and this huge armada of aeroplanes in the sky appeared from inland and then receded in the distance, flying due south to France, which was only about 100 miles, you see, across there. And then another wave come over, and these great waves There were probably fighters above them, a fighter cover above them, but you couldn't. There were so many of the others, the troop carrying planes. I couldn't see any fighters. So I got the call then to report back to Liverpool, and some things I haven't mentioned is about the things that were that made us that they did for a cargo ship like sailing in wartime. Like lifeboats were always swung out when at sea, and like in port for loading, discharging, and they'd have to swing them in obviously on the boat deck, but for quick getaways at sea they were always swung out. And they used to have a long boom between the davits, and they'd lash which would be lashed to the davits, and the lifeboat lashed to this boom to stop the lifeboat swinging about when at sea. You understand what I mean? It was like a buffer then, a stabilized, immovable buffer that the lifeboat could be strapped to when hanging out over the side of the vessel. Scuttles, metal scuttles with louvers were always put in the portholes. The radio room had a protective concrete blocks put around it, about 3 or 4 inches thick, something like that, because of shell fire. You know, the surface vessels would go for the radio room first, as they did. We had an emergency radio aerial. The main ship's aerial had a loop in it in one place, because if a torpedo hit the ship, the masts would whip, you see, and could easily break the main aerial. But this loop was like a safety loop. It would snap, but the loop would perhaps hold it then, you see, with like a fuse, and like electrical fuse in principle. Had an emergency radio aerial. Sometimes an emergency radio room off, a transceiver radio in the motor lifeboat, which was automatic. You could set that off in, you could send off a Morse code signal on the distress frequency, which was 600 meters, and a Morse key, also a manual operation. Cabin doors always on the hook, which left them fixed ajar, because cabin doors had distorted when torpedoes had hit ships and jammed the door jams, you see, and there wouldn't have been no axes in the cabin to get out. There were a lot of guys lost their lives trapped in their cabins that way. And on the older ships, the portholes weren't big enough to get through. On the fort boats, on the Sam Finn, I was later to go on, an American Liberty ship, they were big enough for a man to get through. But on the older ships, the pre-war ships, generally the ships I was on, they were so small you couldn't get through them if you were trapped in your cabin. Ships, of course, were all painted overall grey. Sailing at night was quite a hazard, sailing at night in convoy. I took the wheel one night when I was doing bridge watches. I said I'd like a trick on the wheel, and the mate said okay. And all you had to steer by was that you had the ship in front of you, which wasn't very far in front of you, and it had a faint blue light on the stern. And that was all the guide you had of keeping your distance from the vessel ahead of you, just this faint blue light, because all navigation lights were out and everything. It must have been quite a job, actually, sailing in convoy for the helmsman and that. And I remember on bridge watches, the officer of the watch, he'd be watching the distances of the ship in front and behind all through the watch, and if necessary he would call down the voice pipe to the engineer on watch, up one or down two, and that was up one revolution if the ship wasn't keeping proper station, like if it wasn't keeping up, down two revs if she was gaining too much on the vessel ahead of her. It was a constant business at station keeping, and the Merchant Navy must have done a damn good job, really, because they weren't trained like the Royal Navy to sail in flotillas and things like that. So I went back to Liverpool and was told to by Marconi to go over to the shipping office at Cornhill, and I signed on the vessel, the SS Sam Finn, as the second RO.
This is 6th of July 1944.
That's right. That's it. So, I still could have been going in, over to Normandy. But you didn't know in those days where you were going. I suppose that's what helped to keep the ball rolling, really. So I signed on and went over on one of the old ferries to Birkenhead, and she was lying in the West Float, Birkenhead. I found her to be one of the new American Liberty ships, which were being built in the States at that time. She'd be about a 7,000 ton freighter. I'd seen them in convoys, but didn't really know, hadn't been aboard one, didn't know nothing about them. And I joined her, and there were many crew on board, and I found the second officer in the chart room looking through the charts, and he was very sociable. He said, "We'll go ashore. There's a dance ashore up in the little village ashore somewhere outside of Birkenhead. If you go along with this dance." So we did. We had a nice sociable evening, and it turned out that it was a very happy ship, very sociable crew. They accepted the Marconi operators as one of the family. She belonged to the Donison Brothers and Black shipping line of Glasgow, and she was manned entirely by a Scottish crew, other than about three Englishmen. The second and third sparks were English, and the chief officer was English, but all the rest are Scots. And as I say, it turned out to be a year's trip, a year's voyage, and it was just as well. It was a happy ship, but it really was a happy ship. It was a company that cared for the little things, and which are so big when you're at sea, when it affects your living conditions and day to day existence. The chief steward Willie, he. Wherever we went, wherever it was possible to get fresh vegetables and stores, he did. There was a pastry chef as well, in addition to the cook. And the food wasn't exquisite, but it was very nice. It was very good, as good as you could expect in wartime. The saloon was always kept open at night, and there was quite a social life. We always seemed to have a different card game on ships. On the Fort Elise, we always played Newmarket. On the Argyle, it was bridge, and on this ship, it was solo whist. The second officer was very social minded. He used to run quizzes, things like that, in the saloon. And it was said of being locked at 6 o'clock. It was kept open. Well, until anybody wanted, where it went at any time, anyone wanted to go to bed. It was quite a different atmosphere altogether than previous ships, and it meant so much, particularly living in such a congested environment. Where you're living on top of one another all the time. Well, anyway, this ship, a little bit of history about the Liberty ship was that she was one of the prefabricated ships. It was a system of building ships in America, and it was devised by Henry Kaiser. That was the guy that built the Hoover and the Hoover Dam. And rather ironical that he was a had a German name. And they took the design of the Liberty ship from the blueprints of a British ship that was built in the Tyne in the 20s. The design was built around that, the blueprints of a British ship, actually. And they used to make these prefabricated sections all across America, not just in the ports, and then assemble them in the ports and put them together like Meccano, using electrical welding. Weld all these sections together, and it has been known for a ship to be assembled and ready for sea within a week. 30% of the workforce building these vessels were women. They were doing the welding, but as it turned out, events were to prove, and I didn't know it at the time, and a lot of other people didn't know it, was that there was a problem resulting from the electric welding. Now, when I went on board Sam Finn, I noticed there were steel girders resembling railway lines strapped or welded to the deck just far to the bridge going from one side of the ship to the other, and apparently it was done to strengthen the hull of the ship, because it was found that these in heavy weather and ships loaded as they were in wartime below the wartime line, below the safety plimsoll line, and with deck cargoes as well, on ships that were not designed for deck cargoes, not like your modern conveyor ship, the ship was breaking in two far to the bridge. It was a design fault, in as much that particularly in the colder latitudes, a chemical action was set up within the weld which weakened the weld, hence and then the stress put on the hull of the vessel, bad weather, heavy loads, heavy cargo and all that sort of thing, broke the welds. Now, I can't explain the technical, there is a technical explanation for it, but that is briefly what it was. I learned about this a few years ago, and it must have been the reason why they called those ships Kaiser's Coffins, because they broke off far into the bridge. Well, the armament on this ship was really something. That's one thing about the Yanks, they did seem to do everything properly. Well, she had seven gun pits, each with a 20mm Horlicken cannon distributed in various parts of the ship, a 12-pounder anti-aircraft gun in the bow, and the usual 4-inch gun on the poop aft. She even had a small barrage balloon which could be on the stern, which could be let up and wound down again at will to discourage dive bombers. The metal, the lifeboats were metal, which was an excellent thing for ship, because so many wooden lifeboats had splintered and busted, caught fire, particularly on tankers where there was oil. And well, in 1944, the British were still using wooden lifeboats, and I did read in a Union monthly Union book where an MP had asked a question in the House, when were British ships going to have metal lifeboats? And, there was only about a year to go at the end of the war, and the MP said, well, we don't want people to think that it hasn't acquired our attention and priority, but they were still investigating it. Probably the war was over before they ever had metal lifeboats. They had the metal lifeboats. The radio room was absolutely something modern. The room, there was no old battery box out on the boat deck. The batteries were in a room of their own, a cabin of their own, which was big as a lot of radio rooms had been on ships I'd been on before. She was the first vessel I'd been on that had a radio telephony set. She had three or four different receivers, the main receiver, and then going down in stages. And they actually had a little, mounted on the main receiver, a little box containing a cat's whisker. And it was tuned for the distress frequency of 600 meters, which was the end of the line, more or less, if all else failed. Because a little crystal cat's whisker was so simple. It was basically only a piece of quartz with a little wire to do the detection, and then with just some earphones, and that was it. There was just nothing to go wrong. But how marvelous to think that they'd actually thought of that as well. The accommodation was great, and it was the accommodation for the whole crew, except for the Dems gunners, who were accommodated aft under the 4-inch. The crew's accommodation was centered around, like a block, centered around the funnel. The engine room would have been right below. So there would have been the deck floor, the first floor, and then the second floor, you see. Two stories on. And the deck crew were on one side of the ship on at deck level. The saloon, and they had their dining room there and everything. They had a fridge in their dining room. Where we had a fridge in the saloon. It was the first ship I'd ever been on where there was a fridge in the saloon, big, huge, great fridge. On the first story, the engineers were down one side of the vessel and the deck officer down the other. On the top deck, one side was the skipper's accommodation, on the other side was the ROs. We had the radio room starting in the bow end, the radio room, then our toilet, bathroom, accommodation for two ROs, and then the accommodation for the chief RO, all in one alleyway, you see. And the captain's side took up all the rest on the starboard. So I was on the port, his was on the starboard. And then across a Thorpe ship's, at the head of that, was the wheelhouse, you see. So you had the wheelhouse on this floor, forward, two runs of accommodation, one each side. And then, of course, from the wheelhouse, you could go out onto the wing of the bridge. The saloon, it wasn't the family, nice, big, spacious saloon, not a big family table like on some ships, where the captain sat at the head. There were four tables which accommodated four people, four crew. The captain and chief engineer sat at one of the tables. The three engineers sat at another. I used to share a table with them. The chief Sparks was on the deck officer's table, the chief, second and third mate, and the chief Sparks, that made up the...